Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A growing body of research points to the power of food to influence, for better or worse, our moods. As an example, a research review published in March of last year in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health concluded that, quote, a balanced diet with high intake of vegetables, fruits, and fish was associated with reduced risk of depression, while added sugar, soda, and junk food had the opposite effect. Maxine Smith is a registered dietitian with the Cleveland Clinic. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anne. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So with something like this, I always wonder, is this just correlation or causation? Because, you know, you hear about people when they're feeling down, they say, oh, I'm just going to bury myself in a, you know, a gallon of ice cream and call it a day. Is it cause and effect or is it correlation?
Yeah, that's very true of much of nutrition research. Much of nutrition research is correlation because of the variables and inability to control eating behaviors in studies. But this was an exciting study because it did include some very well-designed randomized controlled trials and steering towards more a cause and effect with very strong evidence supporting the recommendations.
And is it a particular thing in some kind of foods? Is it fats? What do we know? Is there any way to generalize at this point?
Well, when the trend has been to move towards evaluating a diet in its totality, rather than looking at particular foods such as fats or vegetables and fruits or sugar or whatnot, and even more so turning away from the very individualized nutrients, macronutrients and micronutrients, and such as some of the vitamins and minerals. That being said, dietary patterns have been identified across the board, different cultures, different areas of the world that have similar patterns that are related to improved mood which includes energy levels, increased attentiveness, decreased anxiety, decreased depression scores, and so forth.
You know, and it's part of a larger story as in terms of energy levels and activity levels and that kind of a thing. So if somebody isn't exercising as much as they should, whatever that form that might take, is it a function of them just not being lazy and not wanting to exercise, or is there something deeper? Does it have to do with what they're eating and what kind of nutrients they're getting in that way?
Yes, absolutely. What comes first, the chicken or the
exactly.
egg? Exactly. Right? It could be a matter of low motivation. So it could be related to mood. Mm-hmm. Sometimes often changing behaviors takes a certain amount of energy. And depending on where you are and other competing values in your life at this time, you just might not be motivated to do so. Mood can definitely affect that. There are certain, for example, brain chemicals or chemical messengers, neurotransmitters in the brain that are associated with motivation and giving us that drive to change our behaviors and initiate an exercise program. Also, there's the part of our brain that loves to revert to old habits. So if you just started an exercise program and that's relatively new, and you're under a stressful period, the brain automatically wants to revert to some of those old comforting behaviors.
Right.
Which may be on the couch.
Or in the gallon of ice cream. Maxine Smith is a registered dietitian with the Cleveland Clinic, and we're talking about the role that what we eat plays in our moods. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You were consulted for a recent article in U.S. News and World Report on the best food to eat for your mood, plus a few bad foods. The article talks about selenium as a mineral that can help combat mental decline, anxiety, and depression. Where can we find it, and how does it work?
So selenium is a mineral found in many foods. If you like seafood, that's a great source of selenium. So lobster, oysters, clams, other
shrimp?
Types of seafood. Other lean meats. Mm-hmm. And dairy can get bashed, but selenium is found in low-fat dairy products, whole grains. Brazil nuts, one or two Brazil nuts a day, give you all the more than enough selenium that you could need for the entire day. That being said, some of these foods, you don't want to go overboard either. There's a J-shaped curve, so getting enough of these nutrients and different food groups in your diet, you can get a definite benefit. Too much, you can get a negative response. Many of these nutrients cross over with other ones, such as selenium. Many of the foods that are rich in selenium also are rich in zinc and magnesium. And these can work in different ways, many different ways. There's a lot of different complex neural pathways that are involved in mood. Many of these nutrients are involved in the production of these neurotransmitters, such as serotonin and dopamine, which you may have heard of. Others are involved in feeding the gastrointestinal tract and the production of different byproducts in the gastrointestinal tract.
The gut biome, like, is what you're talking about?
Yes, and just the production of other substances that can either affect the gut garden, as I call it, uh-huh. or that microbiome that can affect the cells that line the gastrointestinal tract all the way from the mouth down to the end, and affect that signaling between the brain and the gut. You may have heard that the gut is called the second brain.
Yes.
So whatever we take in our mouth has this, I always think of those little old-fashioned telephones that we used to make as kids with cups on each end mm-hmm. and a wire. So that wire could be the vagus nerve that connects that stomach to the brain. And they're communicating with each other all the time. So what you put in your mouth and eventually goes down into your gut is going to affect your brain, and your thinking patterns are also going to affect your gut. Anybody that's been nervous about something coming up, you can feel those jitters in your stomach as well as your brain. These nutrients can work in a lot of different ways. There's more current research going on into different proteins in the brain. For example, is BDNF. And these different proteins are really set the whole groundwork for building new cells in the brain, for allowing communication networks to take place. It's kind of the background, if I think of a football field, you have all these different players on the field, but somebody's got to be taking care of the turf and make sure that it's uh-huh. smooth so that the players don't trip. So some of these nutrients set the groundwork for brain health. So everything that has to happen in the brain can take place smoothly.
Another lit review published in May in the journal Advances in Nutrition, considered the effect of polyphenols found in a Mediterranean diet. and the effect of them on depression. And of course, here comes this Mediterranean diet again. So many reasons why we hear over and over again, it's not a diet, it's just kind of a way of life, really. What are they and how do they help with depression? Again, is that another one of, it affects the brain?
Yes. Most of these things are affecting the gut and the brain. Polyphenols are a subclass of different plant chemicals or phytochemicals. Polyphenols are described, they're one of the families of phytochemicals that are described by their chemical shape. Many of these different phytochemicals are described by their chemical shape. And easy way to remember some of these polyphenol-rich foods are, first of all, those that we enjoy, coffee, tea, chocolate, who doesn't like cocoa, right? and many of the bright colored foods. And rich colored foods like grapes, berries, some dark citrus foods, spices, colorful spices like turmeric. So these are some of those polyphenol rich foods which have been identified in literature as far as having protective benefits on the brain. If you think about these, compounds in plants, they're in those plants and they protect the plant against different pathogens that could destroy that plant. So in the same way that they protect that plant and allow it to grow to fruition, those same chemicals, when we consume them, they're protecting our body. And many of them can act as antioxidants and fight against inflammation, which we've all heard about.
Moving on to animal protein, is there some better than others, or is it all unnecessary, or what?
Yes, animal protein can be definitely a part of a healthy diet. As far as seafood, if you put that in the animal protein category, mm-hmm. again, that's going to offer selenium, it's going to offer zinc, and the very famous omega-3 fats, which are necessary fats for the formation of healthy nerve cells. And fatty cold water fish, particularly salmon, is a standout as far as omega-3 fat. And some of these components in omega-3 fats, they can affect the genes and turn on genes that make these important neurotransmitters such as serotonin, which can provide a calming, happy feeling. It's known as the happy neurotransmitter. Fish is definitely a good source of protein. Even dairy products again can get bashed, but they're good sources of low fat dairy products are good sources of zinc. There's good sources of magnesium. Other animal fats can be part of a healthy diet. They provide valuable B vitamins, which can be depleted during times of stress. The key is to eat them in smaller amounts than some of the plant-based proteins, like the legumes. Nuts and seeds offer plant-based proteins. Soy products are a legume, which offer a good source of protein. So emphasizing more of the plant-based proteins and fish, and maybe keeping the meats to a less frequent amount, especially red meat, and even more than that, red processed meat.
Okay. Let's see. A real quick question from Karen in Columbus. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to rewind back to the correlation causation discussion. I had a question about, it's my understanding that there's a lot of research that shows that PTSD increases risk for obesity. And so this correlation causation between high calorie foods and you know, weight gain and depression, that research seems to say this is also working in the opposite direction from the research discussed at the top of the segment. Thank you.
Maxine Smith.
Yeah, I'm trying to formulate a better understanding of that question.
Kieran, you're asking, is there a correlation between post-traumatic stress disorder and obesity?
Yeah, I apologize. I'm trying to be succinct because I know you're wrapping up here.
Yeah.
But I was just going back to the expert said that the most recent research seems to indicate there really is a causation between high-calorie foods and depression. And I'm just worried that starts to bleed into, well, you know, it's people's choices that are the problem, where I think there's also research that shows that conditions like PTSD can increases risk of obesity, and, you know, eating high calorie foods cannot cause a traumatic incident. So there has to be something working back that way. And I guess the reason I bring it up.
Go ahead.
Yeah. The reason I bring it up is just the concern of only putting the causation between the high calorie foods and the depression bleeds into this sort of the blaming of folks for you know, what they're eating or how that stuff interacts. Does that make more sense?
I'm thinking that Kieran's saying that food's not the only factor when it comes to the effect on mood and that kind of a thing. And weight.
Yeah, food is definitely not the only factor. Yes, there is a correlation between depression and many metabolic conditions such as heart disease, high blood pressure, obesity, as one of those, for various reasons, the different eating choices such as high sugar foods, high calorie foods, they can affect different neurotransmitters, different chemicals. They can increase cortisol levels, inhibit the uptake of sugar, which is an energy source into the cells. So it can lead to a high calorie processed food diet, can lead to weight gain, but there are often other factors taking place. A person can have metabolic disturbances for other reasons. They could have hormonal interactions taking place, underlying endocrine issues. And a lot of these different systems are all interrelated. So you're going to have the systems going on in the brain and interrelated with the endocrine system, integrated with the gut. So it can be very complex. Medications for depression and anxiety can affect the brain and the way it senses hunger and fullness, and stimulate appetite and blunt the effect of feeling full. So there's many different factors that affect what we eat and how many calories that we eat and how our body utilizes those calories. So solely looking at, yes, calories in and calories out is not the ideal treatment protocol. You really have to look at the person as a whole, their environment, genetics, medications, many factors.
Kieran, thanks for that question. I hope we got to your point there. And Maxine Smith, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Maxine Smith is a registered dietitian with the Cleveland Clinic, and we've been talking about how food can affect your mood. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nearly 1 in 10 U.S. children have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, according to 2016 data from the Centers for Disease Control. The tools used to diagnose ADHD, however, don't always capture the nuances of the disorder. Computer simulations may help clinicians get a better read on the best course of treatment for kids with ADHD. That was the focus of a new research review conducted by researchers at Ohio State and published in the journal Psychological Bulletin. Nadia Ging-Li Lee is a doctoral candidate in computational psychiatry at Ohio State. She led the team. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
So ADHD presents in many different ways, for starters, depending on the personality of the person, I would imagine. But what are the main symptoms? What are the kind of the overarching, everybody agrees that's a red flag?
Yes. So that's a really good question. So the by definition of the statistical manual that is used to diagnose ADHD, it's something very special to that disorder, that it is a disorder of exclusion. So before someone can be diagnosed with ADHD, the clinician or the psychiatrist needs to exclude all other possibilities for the patient. And ADHD is defined as having symptoms that significantly affect multiple different settings. And those symptoms are inattention and or hyperactivity, impulsivity.
Yeah, and they're not always, we always say ADHD, but they're not always presented together.
Exactly. That's exactly also something that we would like to point out more in our review article that we have just published. When we think about ADHD, what usually comes first to our mind is someone that is like a kid in school that does excessively talk to others, that doesn't remain seated, and that gets into trouble because of his behavior.
And a lot of times it could be the exact opposite.
Exactly. So it could also be a child that is like daydreaming and that feels her or himself in like a foggy state and has a hard time to pay attention. And often those children struggle kind of through the entire elementary school and middle school until they eventually seek help. And many people, and what is a little bit sad is that many children who are untreated often develop depression or other disorders.
How is ADHD or ADD diagnosed now? My recollection is it's like 1,000 questions you have to answer as a parent.
Yes, so there are different approaches, but overall, usually it is composed of like two elements. One is questions that have to be answered by parents and usually also by children. So there are like two different sides, because usually, you know, we ourselves see ourselves different than other people do. And so we usually include parent and children questions. And in addition to that, we usually use clinical interviews. So the clinician is inviting the parent and the kid to their office, and they complete an interview together.
Your research looked at 50 studies of cognitive tests for ADHD and how they might be improved by three common types of computational models. So first of all, when we talk about the cognitive test, that's just how the brain is working, just to see how the brain is responding to questions.
So there is also something that we point out in our article. It's not really a common ground yet that you are asking a really good question, and people use different definitions for what they think about when they say a task. And those tasks, we need to go back a little bit in history why we do have those tasks, because I just told you, like, we use interviews and questionnaires, and people may think, well, why are there now suddenly tasks? There has been a movement that we would like to kind of rule out that we misdiagnose children. And that's why we use those tasks as an additional objective measures. And some of the tasks are administered in conjunction with measures such as electroencephalogram that measures the brain activity.
Okay.
And there you are right. Those tasks, in addition with these neural measures, are used to actually see the biological components. But then there are also tasks that are pure behavioral tasks. So people are invited into a laboratory setting, and then they are asked to do a cognitive task on a computer. A very common task, for instance, is the continuous performance task, where children are presented with a stream of letters, and whenever the letter is a vowel, they are asked to press the button, and whenever the letter is a consonant, they are asked to refrain pressing a button.
Mm-hmm.
And those tasks is that task that I just mentioned used because it is widely assumed that it measures inhibition control. And with our latest computational models, where we simulate how we get to the behavior of within such a task, actually kind of shed some doubt on that assumption.
Kids and adults, one of the things I've heard over the years when I interview experts on this issue, and we get callers in as well, say they're filling out the questionnaire for their child, and they say, that's me. They start to superimpose themselves on it, and that's kind of what you're talking about, how people can go through well into their life not realizing that that's what they have. And I guess I'm wondering, are there degrees of ADD and ADHD? And does the testing suss that out?
Exactly. That's a really good question. So I personally believe that there is a spectrum of ADHD, and there is also ongoing literature that compares what if we assume that ADHD is a category by itself. So there is not really a degree in severity, and what is when we assume that ADHD is a dimensional disorder. So there are some individuals, every one of us has from time to time lapses of attention or impulsive acts, but there is really a clinical threshold when it becomes dysfunctional, and in such a way that it affects many settings, like going to work or doing some sport or going to school. And with our models, we also find evidence for this, I call it dimensional perspective of the disorder. And the current movement of the psychiatric association is to actually find possibilities to quantify to what degree does someone suffer from those symptoms.
And in what way? So they may respond to different therapies, and given the kind of buffet of medications out there now, different medications differently, right?
Exactly. And what is also very interesting is that, up to date now, when someone has been diagnosed with an ADHD, the real struggle just begins, because there are so many different treatment options. And what usually the clinician or the psychiatrist is doing is just to try with trial and error, find the right treatment. And that can be very bothersome for the patient. And many of them actually are getting frustrated and also lose hope. And with a better understanding that we do hope can computational modeling add on, we may be able to kind of guide that process of finding the right treatment.
And then you mentioned earlier sort of the comorbidity of depression, and some people have wondered, well, maybe treat the depression first. and not worry about the ADHD or the ADD yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is not a universal law someone can apply. It's
right.
really on an individual basis. And I think, so my premise or why I strongly stand for computational psychiatry is, you know, your previous listener said something very interesting when you were talking about nutrition and depression.
Yeah.
Namely, she said, people's choices are also a problem, how people make choices, what kind of food they eat. And I think that's something that kind of resonates within me, because I do believe that individuals with ADHD or with depression, often they are also helped with if they can understand how do they make decisions and how could they achieve better decisions. And if we find like possibilities to treat with cognitive behavioral therapies, components in their decision process that is like dysfunctional, then they are already helped with a lot.
It's and empowering to them.
Excuse me?
It empowers them to do it.
Yes, exactly. And I think someone with ADHD, comorbid depression may show a different characteristic of how they make a decision than someone who has only ADHD or someone who has only depression. So that's why I think we need to first understand where does the problem occur? Do they daydream? Are they impulsive? Or is it more a matter of fact that they have problems with getting motivated to start something, to start a task or start an activity? And if we find the reasons behind problems, then we can target those specific sources.
So you're thinking of computational models, not just to identify and diagnose ADD or ADHD, but also to treat it.
Yes, it's more like a method to find the right treatment.
Okay.
It's not a treatment by itself.
Okay. And can you give me an example of how a computational model would take you to that next step of finding a treatment?
Yes. So it's actually like the really latest research that I am conducting at OSU in collaboration also with the psychiatric department. So to back up a little bit, many children with ADHD do not respond sufficiently to medication. So it's about one third that do not respond to medication. And neurofeedback has been suggested as a really, really helpful treatment. And the latest research that was conducted by Dr. Arnold at Ohio State was one of the largest neurofeedback treatments. And it showed that children were assigned to like getting active real neurofeedback. And some children were assigned to like getting shame neurofeedback, which was like a pre-recorded neurofeedback from a different child in unrelated different child. And so they found that they could help some of the children, but not all of them. And now the question, of course, the burning question for clinicians and psychiatrists and also patients is, well, how can we assess before someone starts the treatment? Because neurofeedback is pretty intense. One needs to go in 3 times a week over a long period of time. So you don't it's costly in terms of money, but also in terms of time. Mm-hmm. So we need to find out which child could best benefit from it. And our latest research shows that if we let children perform a cognitive task in the beginning, before they start the treatment, okay, depending on how they are doing on that task, and we assess that with our computational modeling, we can predict to what degree they benefit from neurofeedback. And that's like the next step that we are about to go deep into, how computational modeling can benefit clinicians.
Instead of going into cognitive therapy blindly, this gives you some guidance about who might respond well to it and whether it's worth the investment to go forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And another example is also, we know that like there are different types of medication. So for some children, it's very helpful to have a stimulant with that affect certain circuits in the brain. But then we also know that people, for instance, with anxiety do not respond that well to those medications. And so the thing is really we found that out with like observing the responses of patients. But with computational modeling, we can actually get at the source why this is the case. And we can kind of understand, if we take a medication, how does it affect our cognition? How do we start to perceive the world in a different way? And I think that is very important also if we think about those who have comorbid depression. We know that they are usually a little bit more tempted to process information negatively. Mm-hmm. But how does that work? You know, what does mm-hmm. it mean if we process? Somewhere there must be a judgment that comes, that gets added on to the information that comes from our outside environment. And there it's where computational modeling can help us to go and see inside the circuits of the brain why they behave the way they do.
Nadia, I don't know where you're from, but you're not from the United States, I can tell. And yes. And I'm interested in your opinion on what the people think that children in the U.S. are overdiagnosed with ADHD or ADD. You know, I started the whole thing out 1 in 10. That's not the case around the world. What is your sense about why that is? And is it a fallback position, a convenient fallback for people, and that's why they get overdiagnosed?
I think first of all, I'm from Switzerland, okay. And I believe that we have the same issue as the US. So
okay.
There are also some critiques that kind of tell people that ADHD would not exist, or we have many people who tried to get the diagnosis to get the medication because they are performance enhancements.
Yeah.
And so it's very frustrating for those who actually do have ADHD to join the conversation and hear about those things. And I think it's also because there is so much misunderstanding of what what ADHD is about. You know, if we really just consider the child that is fidgety in the chair and that kind of needs to have temper outbursts in order to accept that they do have ADHD, then we miss all the others who are daydreaming and shy or introverted. And I have a hard time to join this discussion with rational arguments, as long as we do not really have a clear definition of what do we understand when we talk about ADHD and what do we do in order to get a good diagnosis. I think everyone would agree with me that we need to have better testing procedures. We need to have standards. We need to find a setting where we can test individuals with the same measures. And there it's where we will gain confidence in our diagnosis or in our or to fight also over diagnoses.
Nadia Ging-Zhi Yili is a doctoral candidate in computational psychiatry at Ohio State. Her research seeks to find better ways to tailor treatments for psychiatric conditions such as ADHD and ADD. And I thank you so much for your time today. Best wishes.
Thank you so much, Anne.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Pulse oximeters, the clothespin-like devices clamped to the fingertip to measure blood oxygen levels, might not work as well on people of color as they do for the rest of the population. That's according to a recent study that showed the devices are three times more likely to give misleading readings in African Americans. During the pandemic, physicians have heavily relied on them to decide which patients with COVID-19 are admitted to the hospital and which are sent home. So coupled with the disproportionate toll the pandemic has already taken on communities of color and the resulting soul searching within the medical field about racial bias, the news about these pulse oximeters reflects a big problem. Dr. Uthibe Essien is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. His research focuses on racial disparities in cardiovascular disease. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Anne.
So let's start with the basics. How do pulse oximeters work? I've always wondered.
Yeah, it's such an interesting theme here in terms of how these machines work, but really they use light to help reflect and determine and identify what our oxygen levels are. You know, you put your finger in this machine and oxygenated blood, which is bright red, reflects light in a certain way and absorbs it through the machine. And again, calculates the amount of oxygen within our blood. And these are machines that have been used for decades now. And importantly, as you mentioned, are really coming to the forefront over the last few weeks.
Why are they show? So we know they're shown to give, are more likely to give an inaccurate or misleading reading for Black patients. Is that because the color of the skin and how it reflects light?
That's exactly right. We believe that it's due to that darker pigmentation in African-American individuals that we're seeing this difference in the accuracy of the oxygen measurements. And these data are not new, actually. There was a study all the way back in 2005, which only looked at 21 patients. So perhaps why I didn't get the same splash that this really huge study that just came out had. But it noted really similar findings that African-American individuals, specifically darker-skinned individuals, had very inaccurate oxygen level measurements with this machine.
Is there an alternative then available?
Yeah, so really the alternative is getting the actual measurement of one's oxygen level in their blood, which is through a needle, a blood draw, basically, but it's through the artery in our arms and our wrists. And so having every individual who comes into the hospital get this blood draw that's fairly painful. It's in your wrist. It's not in the typical crick of your elbow.
Yeah,
it's probably not actually going to be the best way, as you mentioned, to triage individuals, whether they're at home during the pandemic or in the hospital in the emergency room.
So, but we're seeing the evidence that of the disproportionate impact of the pandemic of COVID-19 on African Americans. Something has to be done because we also are hearing these stories about how they're being turned away from emergency rooms, and the readings of these pulse oximeters are playing a big role in that.
Definitely. And so, you know, from my understanding, I would believe that there's three ways that we can address the what do we do, where do we go from here question. For patients, I think don't throw your pulse oximeter machines out. Don't stop ordering them to help your doctor guide your decisions in care. Really understand your body, know what feels normal to you and what doesn't, and almost calibrate your machine in that way. For us as doctors, we have to listen to our patients. For way too long, African-American individuals in particular have been coming to the hospital and saying, I have chest pain, I have abdominal pain, I have shortness of breath, and not having those symptoms addressed in the same way that non-African-American patients have addressed. And even broader at the system level, we have to have these individuals, these device makers, go back and take a look at their data, who are actually in these research studies. What did the color of their skin look like? And how do we start to recalibrate these machines in a way that's more equitable?
So when you say, all right, so the individual, the layperson at home, I got one of them just in case I get COVID so that I can monitor my health if I have to. You know, there was a run on them at first. So, all right, I never use it, but I could even be doing that, just looking at daily looking at my blood oxygen levels. If it is giving you an inaccurate reading at the outset, though, how does that change going forward? Will the reading change the sicker you get?
It should. That's okay. Right. And so just similar to you, Anne, I purchased one right in the beginning of March, you know, wanted to make sure that was something I could literally look at and determine and hopefully help guide me. But unfortunately, as we do get sicker, the way that our lungs oxygenate the rest of our body, that number should start to drop. Of course, again, if you feel any illness, any different from what you usually feel, please contact your health system or health provider, show up in an urgent care. But that number can guide you depending on how you're feeling.
Are you concerned that not enough physicians are aware of this discrepancy and are not applying it appropriately. Like, well, wait, I know about this study, so maybe we ought to take it. Given all the other symptoms, let's go and do the blood draw.
I am. And so, you know, conversations like what we're having here, I think will spread to folks in the Central Ohio area to share just how important these data are. Having this study published in one of the leading medical journals in our country will spread the news out to not just the handful of people who may have read that smaller study in 2005, but hopefully academic medical centers all throughout the country, community health centers, and really have providers know that, look, these data are concerning and we really need to think thoughtfully about what our numbers look like when we see patients of color compared to others.
So step one is awareness in the short term as we plow through this pandemic as it is now. Step two is the manufacturers of the pulse oximeters. What are they saying about this?
Yeah, so it's been interesting to see their reports. There's actually a study that came out or a paper that came out back in August around the middle of the pandemic. And Amy Murray Thomas actually looked and reached out to these device individuals who said, you know, that difference isn't actually that significant. 4 points here or there, maybe that's not too major. And, you know, for us as providers, 4 points can make a big difference between whether you're getting admitted to the hospital or not,
right,
whether you're going to the ICU or not. And so I think we do need to push not just to us as providers or journalists or researchers, but actually have the federal government, state level, and policymakers come and reach out to these device makers and say, hey, we need more data. We need to really push. And again, not just focusing on oximeters, but there's so many clinical guidelines, so many blood work tests that are still have race baked into those processes that we need to address.
Are there any other devices out there that have similarly on different results because of the color of one's skin?
So not too many are using light in that same way that
pulse oximeter
does. That's
the issue here, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, the Lundy Braun actually wrote this book about the spirometer. So speaking, continuing into lungs, there is still till today a race correction on the spirometer, which is a test that we check to see how our lung function is, what our lung capacity is, if patients have chronic lung diseases or asthma. And there is a correction that you can make on that test if you have a black patient in front of you versus if you have a white patient in front of you.
Is the spirometer the thing you blow into and make the little ball? I got one of those too.
So that helps expand your lungs,
that's
but the
like
spirometer
kind of
actually helps to
do.
Measure it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so again, these are based on decades, centuries old data and that suggested that black bodies have less or poor lung capacity compared to white bodies. And there are tests that we run in hospitals every single day that correct for your kidney function and say a black individual should have a certain adjusted kidney function compared to a white individual because data in the past, the old days, suggested that black individuals have more muscle mass. And so all of these tests are really coming into question right now, both on the health system level, policymakers are bringing this up, and it's such an important time because of all these disparities that you've mentioned we're seeing in COVID and beyond.
And it all goes back to the fact that the studies weren't done properly in the first place. They weren't blind. They weren't. They just weren't done properly, but we still rely on them.
Exactly. And they just weren't representative
right.
as well. And, you know, we're having very similar conversations today around the COVID-19 vaccines. And we said, hey, you know, are the right patients in these studies? Are all the patients who we know are going to want to receive vaccination in these studies? And those are efforts that researchers like myself have been thinking about, more community-based folks who actually get to go out and encourage our communities to get out into these studies and learn more about
get
your
into
bodies
the studies.
And
are you confident that the pharmaceutical companies have done the proper representation of the studies of the vaccines?
I think we've moved to a place where maybe 5 years ago, that wouldn't have been a priority. But back in March, we were talking about these themes. My colleagues and I have been writing about this. And so I do think that the pharmaceutical companies really addressed this head on rather than saying, oh, let's in 10 years, look back and wonder, you know, where were there racial ethnic minorities in these studies? And so I am confident that this time around, we did the right thing.
Thank you so much for your time. That's Dr. Uthibe Essien. He is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. His research focuses on racial disparities and cardiovascular disease. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.